Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. It is always a pleasure to have Uwe Simonetto join us. Whenever we have him on, we have learned the best way to utilize this man's talents, knowledge, understanding, and ideas is to simply allow him to take in rapid fire succession a number of issues that he's been writing on, and we have more than we could possibly handle in what the next 40 minutes or so of Issues Etc. We'll be talking with Uwe Simonetto, and then we'll be talking at the end of the hour. You'll be hearing an interview that we did previously today with Dr. Alistair McGrath. Now, if you remember watching that Luther biography that was on PBS last week, one of the people there was Alistair McGrath from Oxford University. And we'll be talking to him about the PBS documentary Martin Luther Driven to Defiance, The Reluctant Revolutionary, the very end of Issues Etc. today. Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. We're going to start out talking with him about a different Luther movie, a full-length feature film on Luther that has just been previewed by Uwe and several others, and we'll see what he has to say about it. Uwe Simonetto, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Wonderful to be back.
Have you had your glass of wine today?
No, it's a whiskey. Wine comes with my food. This is just to prepare to calm my spirits so I can talk to you quietly.
Can I inquire what kind of whiskey?
Would it be Black Scotch? Label, Johnny Walker Black Label, which my wonderful wife hands me next to my keyboard as I'm typing the last lines of today's commentary. This is a nice routine. I make coffee for her in the morning.
What a life.
Yeah, it's Scotch.
Good. I'm glad to hear that there's a fellow Scotch lover here across the airwaves.
Oh, very much so. Yes.
Now, let's start out talking about the movie you just recently previewed with other people in Lutheran circles, the new full-length feature film on Martin Luther. What was the name of the film, and what did you think of it?
Luther. I think it's called Luther, and I think it's absolutely magnificent. It's wonderful. To begin with, it is artistically great. It's wonderfully filmed. It's very fast. It has a good sense of humor. And most importantly, it has what I missed in the PBS documentary, a very heavy emphasis on the gospel. And we were all very pleased with this. Those of us who watched it, it was a small group of people from the three Lutheran denominations, and we thought it was really very well done. And it was historically, except for some details where they took a poetic license, but normally historically it was very accurate and theologically accurate.
What would be your criticism of this full-length feature film on Luther, if any?
Well, one criticism is, for example, that I would have liked to have seen a little more about his relationship with Melanchthon, a little more developed, but we discussed this later. There was simply not enough space for it. Also, his relationship with Catherine von Bora, especially now that the Lutheran parsonage is under threat, you know what I mean? And Luther, with his marriage, really set the pace that shaped our, certainly German society and the society in Lutheran lands, the Lutheran parsonage. That is something that I would have liked to have seen. I would have liked to have seen also more emphasis on his music, but I mean, you know, this is, that, as I'm saying this, I realize that I'm talking another 2 hours of this film, so it's not doable. I just hope that it's going to be another film, or it's going to be turned into a television series. They have a lot of extra film that they could very easily use in that sort of sense.
What do you make of the performances by the actors and actresses in the feature-length film Luther?
I think they were all magnificent. I mean, it's not a single one that I would have. Actually, if Hollywood were fair enough, but I'm not so sure they are. For example, Peter Ustinov as Frederick the Wise. He certainly would deserve an Oscar for that role. It's amusing. He is warm. He is sane. He's wise. Magnificent, one of the greatest performances I've seen by Ustinov.
And the actor who played Luther?
Yes, I thought he was good. I thought he was very, very good. There was some criticism which I do not share. Some people thought that in the early parts of the film where his struggle with Satan in the monastery, and even before it in the monastery, but in the monastery, that he seemed a little hysterical, but I'm quite sure he actually reading all the Luther biographies I've read. I mean, he was pretty nuts in those days until he discovered justification.
All right. Can this movie be distributed? You said that the gospel does come clearly through it, and I understand from reading another review that one Hollywood distributor said, look, it's a great film. We could do great things with it.
You cut out Christianity.
Yeah, you take Jesus out of it, and it'll do blockbuster.
Yeah. Well, I think it can be distributed because it is, as I said, it's a wonderful drama. It's very fast-moving. It is rich to watch. It's just a marvelous picture to watch. And it is fantastic acting. And yes, I think in a period of history, which is quite unique in that nobody stands for anything, here is a man shown who stands for something. And the famous quote, which may be apocryphal, but nonetheless, here I stand. And the film makes it very clear what Luther stood for and what he stands for and why he's important now. And I suspect, I mean, it's not by happenstance that there are so many Luther films and Luther books and that sort of stuff coming out in Bonhoeffer as well. I think there is a desire out there for a film, for a work of art that shows the exact opposite of this disgusting stuff that we're witnessing right now, where nobody believes in anything and everything is relative.
So you're saying this movie really, apart from dealing with the great themes of the gospel in Luther's life, is a good response to postmodern culture?
It is a perfect response to the postmodern culture, and as the French said, it got me in my tripes. I sat there, it shook me, it was something, I cheered him along. Not only because, obviously, because I'm a Lutheran, but even if I weren't, it is so gratifying to watch this film. It really is good, and I just hope to. My God, I wish this film all the success in the world.
Our phone number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Before we go to the phones, how in particular is it a good response to the postmodern, to our postmodern culture?
Well, in particular, it is simply that it shows that the traffic goes from God down to us. It shows Luther's quest for a gracious God, and it shows how to find the gracious God, or rather, that the gracious God finds you. And it shows that this is the only way, and there are no other ways, and so therefore. All the disasters that we are experiencing every day and more so right now are really irrelevant compared with this father-son and father-child relationship that we have got with God and, of course, our relationship with Christ. It makes it crystal clear.
Harold is calling from St. Charles. Harold, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, it's great to hear there's such a wonderful film there. I look forward to seeing it. Uwe, who were the theologians that were consulted in this film? Do you know who they are?
No.
You know, a bunch of us in the Missouri Senate says, oh, we wish there would have had Dr. Kolb consulted in on the television program. Or you probably know Dr. Martin Brecht, the great
yes.
Lutheran scholar, three volumes.
Yes.
Who were the theologians that were consulted
You know,
on
frankly,
this?
I don't know. I know that the EKD, the Evangelical Church in Germany, which, of course, as you know, can be very wishy-washy, was heavily involved in this. But in this particular instance, Harold, whoever was consulted, and I hate to tell you, I have not This is something that I have to find out before I write my review for the Lutheran Witness magazine. I don't know whom they consulted, but it is sound.
And when can we expect Luther to be released?
I believe it's about September 26th or something like that.
All right. You talked before about the postmodern worldview that is, of course, in need of remedy in so many different ways.
Yeah.
What about the Christian worldview? You've written recently about the media and the Christian worldview and how the Christian worldview is imperiled. Tell us about it.
Well, it's imperiled because children or the young are not taught the Christian worldview, even those children who, a survey conducted by Barna out in California, George Barna, and it shows that although 50-odd percent of the young, of the teenagers, have had Christian, some contact with the gospel, and they've had catechism classes, they really could not relate this, or most of them could not relate this to the Christian worldview. They don't know anything about it. Their views are postmodern, they are relativist, etc. And that, of course, the reason is, one of the reasons is obviously the lack of a home where a Christian worldview is being taught by parents, by father and mother together, and not father and mother or something like that, or a single parent. I was too busy doing anything, everything else, and also because one has the feeling that in many congregations, from what I've been hearing and talking to with people out there, many congregations spend too much time socializing with children rather than instructing them.
Now, you also quote in your story Mark Iaconelli,
yeah,
who's director of youth ministry and spirituality at San Francisco Theological Seminary. He says that the media, although it's nothing new here in American culture and worldwide culture, the church has yet to discover how to cope with
the
media.
Yeah, well, it's absolutely true. I mean, the church is actually not even fully aware of the enormous impact of the media and all types of media. I'm not talking about your local newspaper. I'm talking, and not even talking just about television, but the internet, the billboards out there. Games and all these things have an enormous impact, and they have impact children in a way that sells something other than the gospel. Not necessarily evil stuff, but it might sell underwear, or it might sell T-shirts and that sort of thing. And therefore, the church can't cope with it. The church doesn't know how to use the means of the media properly. And more importantly, parents simply do not have the guts or the willpower or inclination to shut off television and to spend time with children, reading them stories, talking to them. If you lock up your kid and allow the kid to play around on the internet, then you have what you had in England just now, that a 12-year-old girl makes contact with a 31-year-old ex-Marine, and the two elope to France. You know, that is the result of this. It is disastrous.
Now, the one reaction on the part of Christians might be to cut themselves off entirely from the media, and others might say, and what we need is an alternative Christian media, our own little ghetto in the world of media. How do you respond to that?
I don't think that we ought to have either. I don't think we should. Certainly, we shouldn't totally cut ourselves off. I'll tell you what. Back in the 70s, a pastor friend of mine in Hamburg, who was a very worldly guy, but he was a good Lutheran pastor with fabulous family. I came to his parsonage. Didn't see a television set. I said, "What's the television set?" He said, "Well, we in the family council decide what we watch, and while we do other things, that thing is locked up." And then I said, "Well, what happens when your kids go to school and during the lunch break or so they discuss last night's talk show or whatever?" And then I said, "Well, my children," he says, "will then answer, can you play the trumpet? Can you play the violin? Have you read Goethe? Have you done this? Have you done that?" And then they're always the winners. Or can you play tennis? Or any of these things. And I think we ought to live with the secular media. Those of us old enough to handle the nastier side can watch it, and then with the others, we'll tell them, "Well, look, children, here's something, a very interesting program on television." And in addition to which, I'd like to tell you this story, and also that we use our own facilities, our television, not the way you have Christian Broadcasting Network do it, but in a way, for example, like turning this Luther film that we just discussed, expanding this into a series. People will be excited about this.
Now, let's talk a bit about what's been in the media having to do with the biggest story of the year, that is Iraq.
Right.
Saddam Hussein's fate is not yet completely determined. He may or may not be alive. Does Saddam, alive or dead, still have allies outside his country, and where would you locate them?
Well, right here in the United States. Right here in the United States. As I told you the last time we spoke, every time you switch on television in the morning and the broadcaster tells you, or the anchorman tells you, last night another two guys have been, GIs have been killed, and that Sergeant whatever is frustrated because he can't get home, although he's a professional soldier and he has been sitting nicely until he was sent to war. I mean, it was his choice. And then we have the presidential hopefuls of the Democratic Party debating in what I believe is really a destructive way, destructive for this country and for Western democracy, debating whatever glitch might have occurred, intelligence glitch might or might not have occurred in the State of the Union address. I find this, in times of war, I find this so irresponsible. And I'm not an American. It's not my, and I don't belong to any party over here. I simply find that particular behavior, be it from the right or the left, utterly irresponsible in times of war, when the Americans are being more and more, and you can watch this in the polls, more and more discouraged, and become less and less supportive of this war, until in the end they say, "Bring the boys home," as they did in Vietnam.
Now, you say there is another means by which those who do have legitimate questions about the president's intelligence or how he used it can do it, and you say go behind closed doors.
Yeah, go behind closed doors. Discuss it. First of all, discuss it in a private session, also with journalists to ask us. I mean, in World War II, and listen, in Vietnam, in the early years, there were the 5 o'clock follies where you had the entire press corps present and some pretty idiotic guys too. And then there was a smaller meeting, what they call the after follies, where good, reliable journalists, and not journalists from one ideological bent or side or another. I mean, they ranged from the New York Times to the New York Daily News and all sorts of others, where we sat down and had off-the-record briefings or on background briefings where we debated this and where they said why this could not be published, and we stuck to this. Same way the media handled this in World War II, where the media themselves exercised censorship because they did not want to hurt their own side or their own forces. And of course, if you are a politician, if you are running for office, your career obviously is not as important as the safety of this nation, as the safety of the Western world, and the absolute necessity to win this war in Iraq against a character who is as evil as Hitler or Pol Pot or Stalin or Mao. I mean, you know, that these guys don't bury their heads in ashes right now, I find it incomprehensible.
Correct me if I'm wrong. If George W. Bush allowed, and his administration, allowed these criticisms, these public criticisms, to take their course and demoralize the American people and said, okay, we're just bringing everybody home, and in effect, chickens out at the end of this war, it seems to me that his critics would then criticize him for leaving the job undone.
Well, absolutely. And then you'd have exactly what happened in 1991 when the Americans, I think irresponsibly, left the Shiites in a lurch, and hundreds of thousands of people were slaughtered. And then, of course, you know, then there was suddenly this criticism against this, although Bush father did so under United Nations mandate. I think it is such hypocrisy. It is so disgusting, and I just wish people would take their politicians to task on this and say, well, look, you are not important. What is important here is our freedom, is our human lives, and is ultimately the success of this thing.
Let's talk about Islam in Europe, if we could.
Yeah.
America has been trying to sort out the Muslim population and how we deal with the Muslim population, largely peaceable here in America. What is the situation with regard to Muslims in Europe?
Well, Muslim in Europe, specifically in Germany, well, in both actually, Germany, France, and Britain, there are, as in the United States, Islamic leaders who would be very good interlocutors with Christians and others, moderate, reform-minded people. But they're A, not in the majority, and B, nobody speaks to them, especially not the churches, which I find particularly disgusting. The churches in Germany, for example, only talk to Islamists who pursue a line which is pretty close to that of Osama bin Laden and at least the Saudi government. That is number one. You have they pressure their own populations. It's particularly nasty in France. The French have been trying to create a sort of national, you might call it, Muslim church, you know, uniting the seven major Muslim organizations into one council, which then would be a partner in dialogues with the government, as would be the Protestant Federation or the Catholic Church or the Jewish Federation. And then they had elections for that council. There were 50 seats on the council, and to their utter surprise, not the guy they intended to become leader, namely the rector of the Grand Mosque in Paris, who was very moderate, won. He only won two seats, but the second largest group were the radical Muslims. So they are much more powerful than anybody thinks. And you have similar situations in England. I mean, you have in England, you have a guy who is a radical Islamist who gets elected into the city council of Manchester, and he doesn't even speak English. So he has to show up with an interpreter. And this sort of thing goes on all over the country. Continent.
We're talking with Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International, running through a number of issues that he's written on recently. When we come back from this break, we're going to talk about the European Union's new constitution, and we'll conclude our conversation with Uwe talking about the Dietrich Bonhoeffer revival, if you will, the boom, how he explains it and how it relates to the theology of the cross. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. This third hour of Issues Etc. will conclude with an interview with Dr. Alistair McGrath. He was one of the theologians featured on the PBS documentary Martin Luther Driven to Defiance, The Reluctant Revolutionary.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International, on the uniqueness of Issues Etc.
I want to know how a Christian is to lead a useful life in this demented world. Sacraments with Jesus talk is not enough. Issues Etc. is the only radio program I know that gives me intelligent theological answers. It balances law and gospel beautifully. It tells me that God calls us even into this perplexing era. It is a program for thinking believers.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift this week. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can make a credit card donation by calling our resource line at 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172.
Moral collapse. Whose fault is it? Answers with Ken Ham, author of the free booklet, Where Did Cain Find His Wife? Well, Ken, it seems every time I turn on Christian radio or TV, I hear complaints about the loss of Christian morality. Who and what's really to blame?
Well, I've heard many reasons. Some say it started when prayer and the Bible were taken out of schools, when abortion was illegalized, and so on. Notice something, though. All these relate to moral issues. I suggest that these are really symptoms of something far more troubling. In fact, the church, not the world, is ultimately responsible. Let me explain. I believe Satan's still using the same tactics he used in the Garden of Eden. He asked Eve, "Did God really say that?" He knew that if he could get her to question the authority of God's word, then sin would follow. Today he's doing exactly the same thing. For 200 years he's been convincing many in the church to reject the Bible's clear teaching about the history in Genesis. So now this generation no longer listens to the Bible's message about morality either that is based in that history. The first step to restore morality is to actually restore the foundation that the Bible's history beginning in Genesis is true. You see, all Christian morality and all Christian doctrine is based in that history. Once people know they can believe the history in the Bible, then they'll be more open to listening to the message of the gospel and the Christian morality that comes out of that history.
Do you have more questions about dinosaurs and the Bible? For the evidence, go to AnswersRadio.com.
AM 850 KFUEL weather for St. Louis. Partly cloudy tonight, a chance of showers and thunderstorms and a low of 75. Tomorrow, partly sunny with the remaining chance for showers and thunderstorms and a high of 88. Partly cloudy and 94 at 531. In traffic, eastbound 70, the entrance ramp to King Bridge is closed. That's due to an overturned trash truck as traffic backs up to west of Adelaide, and 4th Street traffic is heading onto the King Bridge. That's also blocked. Eastbound Eads Bridge is just heavy on the Illinois end. 7 o'clock tonight, eastbound 44 will be closed at Bowles for emergency utility work. And once crews finish there, the westbound lanes will be closed as well. Work expected to wrap up by 8:30. That's traffic and weather on AM 850 KFUO. Stay tuned. Issues Etc. continues.
We know that most of you listen to Issues Etc. in your car on your way home from work. We also realize that since you're still at work, you can't listen to the first hour of Issues Etc. Well, I have good news for you. During the summer months, AM 850 KFUO rebroadcasts the 3 o'clock hour of Issues Etc. weekday evenings at 8. So instead of watching primetime TV, tune in to Issues Etc. again tonight at 8 right here on AM 850 KFUO. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Sunday night on the program, we'll be talking with Wesley Smith of the Discovery Institute, author of the book Culture of Death, about euthanasia and assisted suicide. That's live Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. Now, if you have a question or a comment for Wesley in advance of Sunday night's program, you can post that question or comment on our Issues Etc. forum. Simply go to our website, issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and there you will find a link to the Issues Etc. forum. You can post questions or comments for Wesley Smith on the subject of assisted suicide or euthanasia in advance of Sunday night's program, issuesetc.org, and listen live from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. Our guest is Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International. Uwe, apart from how things are turning out with the European Union, what do you think of the general concept of a unified Europe?
Well, I think the general concept of a unified Europe is a beautiful one, which I heartily support. That has been our dream, even in my childhood, even during the war, that the Carolingian Empire, especially Germany and France, be welded back together. And the concept, the fathers of the unified Europe, especially the fathers of the initial six European nations, Germany, France, Italy, and the Benelux countries, were fervent Christians and did so out of a Christian sense of responsibility and a Christian sense of history. So that was wonderful. The problem is now that we have a politically correct, self-serving European leadership that can't even bring itself, don't even think about God. Just mention the role of Christianity in the makeup of Europe. I mean, that we don't have God in it, and the Constitution is scandalous. But not even mention the historical fact, which you can see at every street corner if you see a wonderful old church or a cathedral or a statue or whatever.
No, part of me says, you know, this is just an attempt to for them to move forward. Part of me says this is a bit of revisionist history, you know, that Europe somehow came into being. Yeah. Apart from the influence of Western Christianity, what do you make of the new constitution of the UE?
Apart from this aspect, I think the new constitution is fine. I mean, there are the, you know, you can quibble with many aspects of it, but basically that the new constitution pretty much leads us into a confederation and possibly even a federation of countries. And I do not believe that in this day and age we can continue in the ways of these old nation states that we had in Europe, as long as we can preserve our cultural identities as French and German, Italian, or whatever, which you can. So in that sense, and of course, there is, you cannot have one market, which is really what Europe is, with a multitude of currencies and a multitude of laws. And I find it very, very attractive. For example, we talked about the Muslims just now. Interestingly enough, when the next batch of Europeans comes in, you know, the Eastern Europeans, the Poles and the Latvians and Lithuanians and the Hungarians and God knows what, when they come in, you have an influx of about 700,000 young workers to Germany. Well, they are much more qualified for the type of work they will be doing than, say, the Turks, because A, they speak the language, B, they have the educational standards, and then they're Europeans. So in that sense, yes, we are growing together, and I have no problem. I just simply hope to God that ultimately they'll find they snap out of this post-Enlightenment nonsense.
And do you see the prospects for a unified Europe, not only in its currency? I mean, the euro seems to be doing fairly well, actually, against the dollar. But in reality, of course, not one language or culture, but a unified Europe in spite of the roadblocks that seem to exist in the constitutional process.
Yes. I mean, look, I'm living this reality all the time. I've been living this reality well before this constitution happened. I have a home in France. I am deeply rooted in France as a German. I'm married to an English woman, so I mean, there are already three nationalities represented here. It's much easier for a European to actually move within Europe than it would be for an American. For example, if you move from Missouri to another state, you might have to take out a new driver's license. We don't have to do that. We don't have to, if you're a pharmacist and you have your training in Germany and you happen to speak the language, nothing stops you from opening a pharmacy in France, or practice as a doctor in France if you're a medical doctor, or practice a lawyer if you do these things. So these things, I find, are a return to a state of affairs that prevailed prior to the nationalist divisions of Europe.
How much do old and cliched stereotypes play a part in obstructing the unity of Europe?
Well, you know, I don't think they're obstructing the unity of Europe, but the old stereotypes exist, as you just noticed, in the flap between the Germans and the Italians. But I don't think one should get one's knickers in a twist over that, because, for God's sake, so all right, so one idiot official calls Germans beer-bellied, arrogant sods. Bathing themselves in Rimini. Well, if you go to Rimini in August, you don't see the most attractive Germans there, because there are so many, and so, you know, a lot of us are not particularly attractive, German or any other nationality for that matter. when you show up in mass, you irk people. There are more stereotypes that I find very irksome, very cumbersome, between Britain and France and Britain and Germany. These stereotypes are extremely dangerous. If a German school teacher teaches in Wales in a private religious school and students greet her with a Heil Hitler salute, or if German kids get beaten up, or if the by the Brits because these kids have, the British kids have been watching too many Hollywood films, or if every other day there is the British popular press insults either the Germans and the French. They're usually the two targets. I find that unpleasant and stupid. But so does my wife, who happens to be British. You know.
Speaking of what George W. Bush has called old Europe, especially when old Europe was old Europe, there seems to be a Dietrich Bonhoeffer boom afoot, not only in Europe, but especially here in the United States as well. How do you explain this, Uwe?
Well, I think the same way that I explain what I perceive as a renewed interest in Luther. Again, you have somebody who stood up for something, somebody to cling on to, who was a genuine hero, as Richard John Neuhaus said, if Rome would ever have it in their hearts to Vatican make a non-Catholic a saint, Bonhoeffer would certainly qualify. It is this. It is also the message that he taught. I happen to believe that the latest Bonhoeffer film by Dobermeier, which I've watched here, has serious problems because the theologians turned Bonhoeffer into something that he was not. They turned Bonhoeffer into an American type social gospel advocate, which Bonhoeffer clearly knows not, because until the very end he was very much a Lutheran theologian. But it's nonetheless the fact that that Europeans have had so few models and so few people are searching. There's a quest out there. You will find in Europe, in many countries, especially in the major capitals, a spiritual renewal, which can also be a Christian renewal, especially in Britain, in France as well. In Germany, it's a little behind. So therefore, in the recent history, in the one history that that really destroyed so much of Europe, to find someone who can be universally admired and actually has something to say into this society, because he was the one who criticized more harshly than anybody the French Revolution, the Enlightenment, and its consequences.
What would Dietrich Bonhoeffer have to say if he were to survey the present state of the Christian faith in his native land, Germany, and alternatively, the United States?
I think he would be he would slam his fist, I'm quite sure, because he wasn't a wimp, and would shout into this society, "You are off course," as much as he shouted into German society in World War II, into the German church, that it was off course. And he would point, just as Luther did, to Scripture. And as I get back to that source, and you'll be fine. And he would say that very forcefully, and as we all know, he had a very, very strong and very elegant language, and he would do so in a strong and elegant language, which is precisely what's missing so much nowadays. You have now the ones who criticize it are doing it often in very simplistic terms. Of course, Bonhoeffer did it in very, very elegant theological terms that nevertheless rang the chords of non-theologians out there among the general public.
How important is it for someone to understand the theology of the cross, that is, that God's favor toward man is discerned only in the cross of Jesus Christ and not in our everyday circumstances, successes, or failures, in order to understand the man Dietrich Bonhoeffer and his work, with only about a minute here before we go?
Well, I think it is immensely important because most people close their eyes nowadays to the cross that they come that they encounter all the time that's been placed on top of them. And they try to shed the cross and pretend it isn't there. And then, of course, it begins to weigh too much, and then they find somehow solace in other things, sex, booze, drugs, and everything else, and pleasure. And we know that this is not going to lead to anything. So therefore, somebody who points to the need to the cross as a reality in everybody's life, and especially in every Christian's life, would be immensely important. It will be immensely important, which is why I also believe that, again, the Luther revival, as I have predicted now, which includes the Bonhoeffer revival, will be quite powerful.
Uwe, I hope we did not interrupt a good glass of scotch by taking your time. Thank you very much for being our guest.
I'll have another one.
Thank you. Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International and a regular guest here on Issues Etc. Speaking of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Issues Etc. book of the month for July is called Till the Night Be Past, The Life and Times of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. The cost of the book is $15.99 plus shipping and handling. Now, you can get more information on the Issues Etc. book of the month for July, Till the Night Be Past, by going to our website, issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and there you'll find information on this book. You can also, to order the book, call Concordia Publishing House tomorrow during regular business hours. The number is 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. The book is a simple biography of a very complex and controversial theologian and man. 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. When you call or write, ask for the Issues Etc. book of the month for July, Till the Night Be Past, The Life and Times of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Now, earlier today, and this is how we'd like to round out our conversation here on Issues Etc. today and this week's live conversations. Earlier today, I had the opportunity to interview Dr. Alistair McGrath. He's principal of Wycliffe Hall and professor of historical theology at Oxford University in England. If you saw the PBS documentary, Martin Luther Driven to Defiance, The Reluctant Revolutionary last week or over the weekend, you might have recognized Dr. McGrath as one of the theologians featured on the PBS documentary. In this conversation, I began by asking Dr. McGrath how he became involved in this PBS Lutheran documentary.
The producers were interested to find somebody who would be able to talk about Luther's religious views, and I think they felt they wanted someone who would be sympathetic to his concerns, but able to try and explain them in terms that would make sense to an audience which would be largely secular. So that they came to me and asked me if I thought I could do it.
And do you know anything about the production company that put this documentary together?
I hadn't worked with them before. What attracted me about the approach they suggested was that they were quite clear that it would generate a lot of interest in Luther outside the normal circle of people who would be interested in him as a historical figure.
How long did they interview you to make your addition to this documentary?
We basically took a whole morning filming in the chapel of Exeter College in Oxford, which is a very sepulchral place. It's very atmospheric. And they must have edited it down from that, because certainly we covered a lot of ground in that interview, and we wouldn't have been able to use all of that in the documentary itself.
What kind of questions were put to you, not only of an historical nature, were there theological questions put to you as well?
Yes, they were trying to get me to explain in very simple terms that laymen might be able to understand at least some of Luther's religious concerns. I don't think all of those found their way into the actual program itself.
Now, one of the things that I observed when I watched this documentary, I noted that it could have emphasized Luther's theology more. Did the questions that they ask you reflect more on Luther as an historical figure or as a theologian?
I think it's fair to say that they were primarily interested in Luther as a figure of flesh and blood, a sort of historical living person. They did give me an opportunity to talk about his religious ideas. These were in the form of a number of questions about leading aspects of his thought. Again, I'm not sure all of those found their way into the final version of the documentary.
Have you seen the documentary?
I haven't myself. I have it on tape, and I hope to watch it.
What kind of feedback, if any, have you received from the Luther documentary and your involvement in it?
I've received a lot of feedback, and it falls into, broadly speaking, three categories. The largest category by far is from people who've written to me or emailed me saying, we must find out more about this man, Luther. We heard of him in history books, but didn't realize he was such an interesting person, and asking for recommendations for suitable books to take their study further. A second major category of people, interestingly, is from Roman Catholic viewers of the program who wanted to quiz me on why I had taken a supportive attitude towards Luther when, in their view, Luther was responsible for the division of the Western Church and was therefore quite a bad thing. And I received a small number of letters or emails from I guess primarily Lutheran pastors wondering why there wasn't more in the way of explicit engagement with Luther's theology. And I'm sure that's some of the things you're picking up from your audience.
It certainly is. Here's a typical example. We'd like your reaction to this. This one comes from a recent guest on our program, Dr. Ron Feuerhahn, who's professor of historical theology at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Here it is. I'd like your reaction.
One of the things, however, that was very disquieting to me is the way in which there's the emphasis upon Luther the rebel and the individual. And that emphasis upon the individual, I don't really find in Luther. There was one time in which I said to my wife, I said, oh, no, no, no. And then later on they corrected themselves, as it were. I forget right off what it was, but it had to do with the way in which this was coming out. And Luther was a man who was not trying to leave the church. He did not want to have himself apart from the church. And that was a clear impression I had last night. I don't know if that was really what they were getting at all, but that was one of the most disquieting things, the idea that the church, in its flawed nature, was to be shunned.
Now, that's Dr. Ron Feuerhahn. Your reaction, Dr. McGrath?
Well, I see exactly what his concern would be. I think the concern of the producers was to produce something that would be interesting to a wide audience, and that their emphasis on Luther as an individual in many ways involves projecting back onto that period some stereotypes, some ways of thinking, which are more typical today than that period. And certainly from the discussions I've had with the producers of the program, my hunch is that they would not really have been very interested in the whole side of things that has just been mentioned. For example, Luther clearly defined himself not so much as an individual, but as someone who was part of a much greater church-based or gospel-based way of looking at things. So I would certainly resonate with that.
What is the most misunderstood aspect of Luther's life and work, in your opinion, Dr. McGrath?
I think there are two things that I regularly get in public meetings or in private discussions with people. Number one, Luther was just a frustrated German Catholic monk who began the Reformation in order to get married. Now, I'm able to refute that one quite easily, but it's very interesting that stereotype is around. And the second stereotype rests on, as you know, a letter that Luther wrote to Melanchthon saying, pecca fortiter, you know, be bold, go and sin boldly. And again, that's very often cited as showing that Luther is ethically promiscuous, which of course is quite far from the truth. Luther was, in effect, pointing out to Melanchthon that Christ died for real sins, and we need to really appreciate the immensity of what he has done. So those are the two misunderstandings and misrepresentations I encounter most commonly in public speaking. But there are others, of course, in more academic contexts, which very often rest on Enlightenment historiography, which improperly projects present-day concerns back onto the Reformation itself.
Do you consider a documentary like this that does, as you have said and others have observed, focus more upon Luther the individual, Luther the man of flesh and blood, do you yet consider this, though, an opportunity to begin dialogue with unbelievers, having generated an interest in this great theological giant, Luther?
Yes, that's a very good question. I think I'd like to begin by stressing that my understanding is that this documentary perhaps was inaccurate in some of the statements it may have made, particularly about Luther's theology. So let's agree with on that. But my impression from my correspondence is that the documentary has generated a new interest in Luther outside the normal constituency who would want to know about him. And what I found is people saying, you know, we watched this documentary and we didn't understand all of it, but this clearly was a very interesting man with a real passion for God, and we'd like to know more about him. So I've referred them to, for example, Bainton's Here I Stand and various other books like that, which I hope would begin them on a journey which actually might help them to appreciate more about Luther than that documentary was able to explain. In other words, that documentary seems to have sparked off interest in Luther, which we can follow through by appropriate guidance. And my hunch is that probably without that documentary, there'll be quite a few people around the place who might not today be thinking about Luther.
Dr. Alistair McGrath, thank you very much for your time and for being our guest here on Issues Etc.
It's my pleasure.
That's an interview we had earlier today with Dr. Alistair McGrath, principal of Wycliffe Hall and professor of historical theology at Oxford University in England. If you saw the PBS documentary Martin Luther, Driven to Defiance, The Reluctant Revolutionary last week or this weekend on PBS, well, Dr. McGrath was one of the theologians featured there in that PBS documentary. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., a two-hour discussion. The question is, who is Jesus? Ken Samples of the Augustine Fellowship Study Center will be our guest. Also tomorrow, part two of our broadcast on feminism, our guest Phyllis Schlafly of Eagle Forum. Sunday on the program, euthanasia and assisted suicide, Wesley Smith of the Discovery Institute is our guest, live Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. And stay tuned for Monday as well, when we get a response to a recent column in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Maybe you read it. It was written by Sylvester Brown. It was titled, Church's Mission to Save Gays is Missing the Point. We'll get a response from a freelance writer, Helen Louise Herndon, Monday on Issues Etc. You know, there's a lot of talk out there in the church. Invoking Luther is the radical individualist, the revolutionary, the innovator, the iconoclast, the anti-traditionalist reformer. It's a false view of Luther, under which a lot of mischief has been perpetrated in the church. Luther was not about revolution, but about reform. He was not about doing away with everything the church stood for or was. He's about returning the gospel of Jesus Christ to the church and allowing that gospel to do what it does in the church all the time, reform it. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Today's Issues Etc. broadcast was partially underwritten by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Till the Night Be Past, a biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Information is available from Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or go to issuesetc.org, and under the What's New section, you'll find information on our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Till the Night Be Past.